Count on Booker T and the MGs, the Memphis group, to give us good lead-in, especially on a beautiful spring day. Isn't it gorgeous? What a winter. Good afternoon, everybody. I do mean good. Stan Turner with you here, the self-named show, Stan Turner Show. Thank you so much for your company. Please take us with you as you go about your day today. I hope you're going to get outside a whole lot. Kyle, you're stuck in here for a while. My wonderful producer here, Kyle. How you doing? You got rid of that silly wool hat, finally.
Yes, I did.
Took 80 degrees to get rid of that thing,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have a good week?
Absolutely.
All right. You ready for a good show?
I don't think I couldn't be.
Okay, that's very political, diplomatic answer. Well, if you like to rock and roll with some hot stuff from some years ago, you're in luck today. Folks, thank you for joining us. We really got a winner for you here today. By the way, if you are a military veteran who's had trouble with the law, or you know a vet who has, we have a special segment for you in the latter half of this hour. Washington County Attorney Pete Orput is going to stop by here to tell us about veterans courts. It's a way to help end the cycle of veterans getting crosswise with the law, if you know what I mean. Getting arrested, prosecuted, incarcerated, and released, only to go through the whole thing again, in some cases again and again. That segment, yes, Pete Orput in veterans courts, down toward the bottom of the hour. But first, oh, boy, let's go back in time for a moment. How about 1956? How about 59 years ago? It was just about this time of year that pop music fans were squeezing into the St. Paul Auditorium. Elvis, yeah, the Elvis was the headliner, and fans were primed for a blowout night of rock and roll. But before Elvis took the stage that night, promoters had booked a St. Paul guy named Garcia, Augie Garcia, to warm up the crowd for Elvis. Did I say warm up the crowd? Augie and his band came on like a blowtorch, and the fans went nuts. And it sounded something like this.
Well, you cross the bridge to Mendota Sea, way down deep to dig the scene. You're knocking on the door and you feel your best. A real crazy captures me, my guest.
Augie and his band were so hot that night that Elvis Presley's heavy-handed manager, Colonel Tom Parker, cut Augie's performance short, fearing the St. Paul guy would upstage Elvis, huh? The details vary, but it really did happen. Augie Garcia was the center of pop music gravity around here back in the 1950s. The name has largely been forgotten, but no longer. We can thank History Theater in St. Paul for reviving the name, the stories, the music, and the memories, and keeping them alive. That's because of a new musical that debuts tonight at History Theater. It's called River Road Boogie, the Augie Garcia story. Don't miss this one, folks. In studio this noon, the man who wrote the play, the musical, Joe Manjaris, and actor Sean Hamilton, who portrays Willie Brown, one of Augie's saxophone players. And we have our longtime friend and artistic director of History Theater, Ron Peluso, with us. Welcome, everybody.
Great to be here, Stan.
Nice to be here. It's good to be here. It's good to be any place, but especially here.
Well, actually, it's not so good to be inside right now. That weather
right,
out there is great.
Joe, you're not going to leave right now, are you? Huh?
No, I'm not.
You've got to stay here and talk to us about what you have rocked, what you have put together. First of all, either Joe or Ron, can a performer wearing a sport coat, Bermuda shorts, knee-high black socks and white shoes succeed in show business? I guess we found out it could. That was Augie's getup, wasn't it?
It was.
Well, you know, when I first got the commission to write this play, I thought, well, here's a story about a guy who his career was taking off, and then he didn't want to go on the road, and then his career went away. It just died, and I thought, well, you know, who cares?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Even though he was a great performer. But then I started talking to the different people involved, his wife and his army buddies, and especially Cornbread Harris, who was their original piano player. And Jimmy, he summed it up. He says, man, he says, that cat, he was not a great guitar player. That cat was not that good as a singer. He says, but as a performer, that dude was deadly.
He's scared. He put the fear of God into Colonel Tom Parker that night,
yes,
didn't he?
Did. Huh?
That actually happened. I think it's part of the
yes,
play.
Yes, it is. Okay. It is part of the play. And I heard various versions of how it happened. But basically... he was afraid that Elvis was going to have a hard time following that act.
So how do you top that act?
That's right.
So he got the hook, huh?
Well, according to Cornbread, the colonel stepped up, whispered in Augie's ear. He says, "You're done." He says, "Well, you know, we've got three songs."
Yeah.
He says, "No, you're done.
You're done.
We do the rock and roll here." And Augie turned to the band. He says, "Pack it up, boys. We're done, but we're getting our money." So,
Joe, Ron, let's talk about who was Augie Garcia. Local boy, we know that.
Local guy, yeah. I mean, I was desperately searching for a project about Minnesota rock and roll, and I just went on the internet and I saw this wildcat with his guitar and Bermuda shorts, and I thought, what is this? Because I'm a Pittsburgher, not a native Minnesotan, so I didn't know the history of Augie. And the more I learned about it, the more I was intrigued by this incredible character. And not just because he was a great musician, but because of what people thought of him in the community. He was regarded as somebody almost saintly. He was such a great guy. Everybody loved Augie.
Joe, it's true. Joe, tell us about a little bit more about Augie. He grew up over west side of St. Paul.
He grew up on the west side of St. Paul in that Humboldt High School area there. He was a Mexican-American. His parents were migrant farm workers. They worked the sugar beet fields. And it mirrored our experience. I'm Mexican-American from Minneapolis. We had our little colonia over there. And we had heard of Augie. I mean, we were always proud whenever we would hear another Mexican was making it. So I heard of Augie growing up, but I had never seen him perform. And but the West Side was a hotbed of music back then. It was like this cooking cauldron of cultural experience and sounds and food. And
yeah.
I mean, it mirrored again the North Side, where the first Jewish people moved in and settled it, and then they rented to the blacks and the Italians, and then came the Mexicans, and so especially right around that era in the late 20s, there was a big migration of Mexican people that settled there.
Joe, when Augie was coming up as a kid in the 40s, and then getting his musical act together in the 50s, what was the music scene around here in the Minnesota Wisconsin area at the time?
Well, maybe Sean can.
Can Sean, you want to roll in?
Yeah, babe.
Yeah. Sean Hamilton portrays Willie Brown in Boogie. That's River Road Boogie, the Augie Garcia story, which premieres tonight at History Theater. Sean is, among other things, going to be playing tenor saxophone up there, baby, huh?
That's right. Go blow some tennis down.
I pretend to be a tenor sax player. You are one, my man. Yeah. What about the music scene, Sean? What was going on around here?
You know, you got to remember, a lot of these cats came back from the Korean War. And, cats now, you get your computer, your iPod. If you wanted to have some fun then, you got a guitar, you got a sax, and you learned how to blow. You know, that was your fun. So a lot of these, your garage bands, people were really influenced by, music coming out of New York, out of Elvis, out of a lot of rock and roll coming out. And so they wanted to do it. And they wanted to throw off, you know, the war and all that stuff that they had been going through for the last 20-some years. So when these cats came back, you know, they blew up. You know, they wanted to get out there and really start the scene.
This is the post-World War II and post-Korean time. The big band swing.
That
was going away.
That's right.
New
That's
stuff
right.
is coming in.
Well, That's right.
The other thing was economics. You know, the club owners. It was about money. It was about instead of paying a 10-piece orchestra or 20-piece orchestra. I mean, all of a sudden these guys were showing up with a bass and a couple saxophones, a piano and a guitar, and you're paying a third for a big sound.
This was blue collar work. You got to remember how many bands there were around at that time. Every club, every bar, you had to have some guy up there playing. You didn't have the recorded music like you do now. You weren't paying ASCAP to some dude in New York. You were paying like dues and real money to some guy who lived on the North Side.
Before Augie headed off to the Korean War, he put together a group, I think called Continentals. Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
Among many other things I want to mention, this was a racially integrated musical ensemble, which was not all that normal back in those days. I can remember in the 1960s reading up groups like the Crests and the Del Vikings were racially integrated. That was almost a novelty back there.
Well, part of the problem was the clubs. You know, you could have a group that was a black group or a racially mixed group, but the problem was whether the club was going to let them play in the club. And some of them, you couldn't even walk in the front door. The same club that you'd be playing on the stage, you'd have to go around to the kitchen to come in. So the main problem was whether the club wanted that group.
Wow. Well, you mentioned Cornbread Harris, father of Jimmy Jam.
Yes.
Okay, boy, a force to be reckoned with in the music. his yeah. So Cornbread was an early member of the Augie Garcia
right.
musical ensemble.
And Augie himself said that a lot of their music was Cornbread's music.
How about their signature song, Hi-Yo Silver?
Hi-Yo Silver. A lot of people think it's
this
Hi-Yo
is not
Silver.
Lone Ranger, man. This is Hi-Yo Silver. Yeah. Not to be confused with Clayton Moore and the Lone Ranger.
Well, he means like Daddy-Yo. You know, he took that hi-ho, turned it into the yo.
Right, Kyle, we got to get you back in here so that we can hear Hi-Yo Silver. My producer is roaming around out there. We want to hear a little. Can we do a little sampling here? Okay, let's bring in something inspired by Cornbread Harris and played by Augie Garcia and the Quintet. Hang on, everybody. Hi, yo, Silva.
Big Daddy O, here he comes now.
Who?
That's the Lone Ranger. And he's singing, hi-yo,
hi-yo, Silva.
And stop your jubilee jam. Hey, come on here, baby, and stop your jubilee jam. Now don't give me no bad, cause you big fat hog, you don't want no talking back.
I do hear a tenor sax blow in there, and I do believe I heard the name Jimmy Jam in
right,
there.
Right.
Did I?
Jimmy
did
Jam.
I? Okay.
Stop you, Jimmy Jam.
This is an actual recording of Augie Garcia.
What a hip time! That guy was really well. The way he played with time, man, that dude was really hip.
He really did. Joe, all this happened, and Augie really got cranking musically after his return from the Korean War, right?
Yeah.
He got beat up in the war, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was one thing about Augie that a lot of people don't realize, that he was in a what they call a bastard unit, the 96th Artillery, and they participated in the Incheon landings, and they were all over Korea, and they were in an area called the Punch Bowl that was really, really a bad place to be. Augie did the elevation whenever they would do a fire mission, and he would do the elevation and set the guns but their forward positions got overrun a couple of times, and Augie was in a bunker, and the bunker took a direct hit and buried him and five other guys. They dug him out, and you know, Augie was there too when he lost his best friend, a guy by the name of Harvey Walters, who was trying to get a truck. He was trying to get a truck so they could get their stuff in there. They saw the South Korean soldiers that were there to protect him were running, dropping their guns and running, and so they were there, you know, exposed, and it was pretty bad.
Maybe the best therapy, post-traumatic therapy, was music. So when Augie came back to the States back here, by way of Hawaii, by the way,
yes.
Where he discovered Bermuda shorts, is that right?
That's right.
Took a strong liking to him, did he, Sean? Yeah, huh? And that became his trademark, too. And so he got cranking with the music, and I think it was restorative for Augie after the war hell he had been through.
Right. Yeah, and you know it was a statement. It was a bold statement that he was making, that he was there to play music and play it his way.
Yeah.
Those shorts represented a lot.
It was kind of freedom for him. You know, it was like, I'm going to do it my way.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. Sean Hamilton, you portray Willie Brown, one of the sax men. What about this character, Willie Brown? Who was he?
You know, Willie Brown was a young man. He got brought into the band by Cornbread Jimmy. Cornbread Harris. And, you know, he started playing with Augie, I think he lasted with the band maybe a couple of years, and then he went back to school again. But, you know, it was a really important part of his life. Yeah.
Okay. Joe and Sean, got to ask you, okay, here's this talented guy making a lot of musical waves around here. Why did he not go national? He had the chops to do it. I mean, he did. Huh?
That's the mystery, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
that is one of the mysteries about Augie Garcia.
Joe, does your play get at that?
Well, yeah, it does.
Okay, I don't want to steal all the thunder.
Yeah,
here,
we couldn't. I don't think there is a real answer unless you could get into Augie's head. But he had rules. His main rule is that he didn't want to travel farther than a day's ride. And that's not really? Very far back then.
No.
So that's like no. coming to Stillwater.
Yeah, right.
Get you here.
And, you know, there were some places where they couldn't play. I mean, or they wouldn't play because of racism. There was clubs very close to here that wouldn't let him use the front door. So he.
I mean, actually, some of the mobbed up clubs were the ones where they were able to get in a little even easier than they.
Interesting term, mobbed up clubs.
Yeah.
How do we define that?
Certain individuals who collectively work on criminal activities might be.
Back then, they called them the gangster clubs.
I think we're getting the picture there.
Yeah.
What about the River Road Club in Mendota? That was very welcoming to Augie. That was his main performing venue, wasn't it, for a while?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was an icon back then. It's a this little shack next to the river, and it was almost walking distance from the west side. But yeah, all the bands wanted to play there. It was a hot spot. A lot of the local talent coming into town would hear about the River Road Club. You know, they'd play in Minneapolis or they'd play in St. Paul at the bigger clubs and or at the Prom in the Midway, and then they'd shoot over there to catch the show.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the other venues. You mentioned some. The Padded Cell, remember that one?
Yeah,
on
I
Lake
remember
Street?
That place.
Yeah, Lake Street. The Loon, that became Mr. Lucky's.
Mr. Lucky's, yeah. And then later Mr. Magoo's.
Yep, and then there was Swedes. Augie and company played
right.
Swedes, huh? How's that sound?
Swedes, yeah. Sweet.
Yep. The Torch. And Duffy's Bar, and they opened, Augie and company opened for the likes of Chubby Checker and Little Richard.
Right.
I'd give anything to know what Elvis thought of Augie Garcia that night in May 1956 at the St. Paul Auditorium when his manager pulled those guys off the stage. What I believe is true of Elvis, he was hey, man, leave them alone. They're great.
Yeah, I don't think Elvis was afraid to follow anyone.
I don't think so.
We had somebody at the show last night who said they were there and they said,
really?
One of the women said, I don't remember that happening. And Joe told me the story. And, and her friend said, you were drunk.
You were drinking.
That would do it. Oh, man. Ron Palooza, you're the forgotten man over in the corner. How's it feel to be forgotten, Ron, over there? Can you pull the microphone over? How big of a cast do we have here? How many musicians will be on stage? What are we going to see in here tonight?
Well, it's a big cast show for us. There's like 15, 16 people.
Wow.
We have some high school kids who are from the St. Paul Academy Conservatory dancing with the show. And
that are absolutely fabulous, by the way.
Yeah, I believe it. Augie did not cut all that many records. I think, about four records, so eight sides. We played a couple of them here already. We're going to hear the whole lot, I would hope.
I think you'll hear most of his repertoire. And the family's coming tonight, so there's like about 120
really?
Family members showing up.
Well, his widow's still around. Is she
Nancy will be there tonight, and we'll probably introduce her before the show begins.
Yeah. I hope so. Ron, you are given to welcoming everybody, especially on opening night. You get up on the stage and say a few words, don't you?
I usually do.
I critique you. I don't say anything too loudly, but I think you ought to wear Bermuda shorts tonight.
What do you think, Sean? Joe?
I think so, too.
I think you should wear the ones that he's got on.
With a jacket.
You got good knees for radio, Ron.
I think you should
go
out and buy a tuxedo.
You got him back. Yeah, you got him back.
He's got good legs for radio.
Cut the pants.
Yeah, cut the pants up.
Speaking of tuxedos, is it true that Augie Garcia actually had his tuxedo pants cut off like Bermuda shorts do?
Well, that was an accident.
Oh.
That was an accident. Okay. See, he would buy pants and have his mother cut off the pants.
Yeah.
And then he had his tuxedo there that they were going to use for this big gig, and his mother thought, well, he must want them cut, so she cut them.
All right. Sean, what's your favorite part of the show here? What are the songs you like best you can really... I imagine we're going to have some tenor sax.
You know, man, I love Ivy League Baby. I think Ivy League Baby's got a great sax hook on the top. That one's fun. I love all the shout choruses that I get to do with my buddy Ben.
Give me a little sample. Come on. How about a shout?
Ben.
Okay. We'll come tonight.
Okay. You come tonight.
You got to pay for that.
All right. You got to pay for that. Joe, what else do you want us to know about this musical you put together? Move in tight here, man. This is show business. Come on.
I'm just so proud to have been a part of this thing, and especially because it has this Mexican-American theme to it, and it's part of our history that a lot of people don't know about, I want to thank Ron for giving me this chance, and Sean here is just He takes my breath away when I watch him perform up there. The whole cast is just fabulous. The music is
this
great.
Is the most fun I had in a long time.
Yeah. That's the ultimate compliment, huh? I like the way you put it. Sax hooks. We love sax hooks, don't we, huh? Bass lines and right. Sax hooks. Exactly. Augie Garcia, his band went away in the 60s, right? The guys just left. Augie went on Ron Joe as a solo for a while, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, you know, he got sick. Of all things for Augie Garcia, he got throat cancer.
Yeah. Oh.
And he played solo at these different clubs you're talking about, and then he went away. And then they wanted to do a reunion show at the Prom in the Midway, and he wasn't sure anyone would show up. And the ironic thing is they did the show, and they packed it. And then they did another show, and they packed it. And at one of the shows, a guy came up to him and said, "Would you sign my Augie Garcia album?" Augie signed it, and he said, "Where did you get this album?" He says, "I bought it in London." And Augie said, "I never cut an album." So that's the ironic thing.
What? But it was an album?
It was an album.
And a bootleg or something? Wow.
Right. Remember, he used to be he was a steel worker.
Yeah.
After he
Hoisting Derrick.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So after the band broke down, he went back to working in steel work. And there are a lot of great pictures of Augie Garcia, you know, leaving with this group of guys, just like he might leave with his guys in the army or with his band. He was with a big group again, and he's up there doing that steel work.
There's a Yiddish word, mensch. I think the guy was a mensch. An upstanding human being. Wasn't all absorbed in himself.
I don't think Augie ever really fully understood how important he was to people. After talking to his buddy, that Joe Leon, his army buddy who lives in Blaine, he told me, he says, you know, Augie would at night would play and it would take away the pain. He said we'd forget about all these terrible things that we'd see. He says I don't think Augie ever really fully understood what he meant to us.
What if he'd gone, tried to go national? Do you think he could have made it, competed out there? We're talking about, talk about a time of ferment in the musical business. Yeah. You'd be up against Little Richard. You'd be up against Jerry Lee Lewis. You'd be up against all those cats.
But you forget, it's not, you know, maybe he wouldn't be Jerry Lee Lewis or whatever, but Augie would have worked,
oh,
man.
No, I know.
That
I'm not saying he wouldn't.
Yeah.
But I'm saying you're up against some heavy hitters, all right? Huh?
No, Augie had the chops to do it, and I think that band would have worked everywhere.
I'd like to hear that, Joe.
But there would have been concessions that he would have had to have made that. I don't think he would have. Did you see that documentary about Looking for Rodriguez?
Did not.
Okay, it's about this this musician from out of Detroit that was as big as Elvis over in Europe, and here no one knew about him. And in the documentary, they said he couldn't make it here because of that name. Augie Garcia probably would have had to change his band to something else, not the Augie Garcia Quintet.
And might have lost the magic, huh? Anything? Huh?
I don't know if he would have lost the magic, but he probably would have had to commercialize, and I don't think he would have done that.
I'll tell you one thing. Thanks to you, Joe, and certainly to Ron Peluso in the theater, and you, Sean. We've been bringing back a name and a time and a artistry that otherwise would have been free. It's receding further and further into time as the years go by. Now, back front and center. Yeah. And that's we thank you all for that. Folks, go to this. Premiering tonight at History Theater in downtown St. Paul, River Road Boogie, the Augie Garcia story. Ron? Final word or two as we hear Augie in the background here?
Well, it's a great tribute to Augie and also the Korean War vets who came back and became part of the fabric of our country. And they're starting to disappear now, too.
They'll be in the audience, too. I know that. Ron Peluso.
Bring a vet to the show tonight.
Absolutely. Really. Great. Joe Mangeris, thank you, Joe. The playwright, Sean Hamilton, one of the actors and sax players, doing some sax hooks up there.
That's right, baby.
Ron Peluso. I'll see you. I have the honor of being there tonight. We'll see you all. I'm looking for a great time. We're going to blow the roof off. Huh?
Thanks, Stan.
All right. Thanks, everybody. That's it. We'll be back in just a minute.
Wolf Beer in the Bottle isn't just another bottled beer. Why? Remove the cork to find out. Yes, that's real cork. Now pour. Taste. The Strong Golden is a Belgian-style ale featuring local honey from the valley, chamomile, and rose hips. Are you ready to enjoy? Go to wolfbrewing.com and click on Beer Finder. Then ask for Wolf's, Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater. They've been sitting on that shelf for years. Those special memories of your childhood on slides, videotapes, or 8mm film. You want to share them, but you don't have a way to do it. Now is the time to let images of the past do it for you, and you'll have those special memories to share with the family. Images of the Past can transfer your memories to DVD to be enjoyed anytime by the whole family. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past and at imagesofthepast.com.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
What are you showing there, Kyle, the way of temperature? Do you have a thermometer in front of there?
This one's saying 73.
73. We're climbing toward 81 degrees. And let's just see for tomorrow. I know you want to know. Overnight tonight, 58 degrees. And partly cloudy skies tomorrow. Well, we pick up a 70% chance of rain, mainly after 1 tomorrow afternoon. But the temperature is the good news, too. 82 degrees for a high tomorrow. Cool down a bit on Monday, sunny skies, and 73. Right now, we're about in that temperature range. It's 1232 right now, and we keep moving on right here. I'm guessing most folks do not know, but March 29th is set in state law as Vietnam Veterans Day in Minnesota. Every March 29th, groups of Viet vets, their family and friends gather to mark the occasion, the camaraderie, the good and the bad memories, including the memories of returning soldiers getting a less than cordial welcome home after their service in Nam. This past March 29th, that was a Sunday, I had the honor to MC a gathering of Viet vets and their friends at the American Legion Post in Forest Lake. I wish you could have heard the keynote speaker, Pete Orpett. Is a Minnesotan, a Vietnam veteran, and currently county attorney in Washington County. Pete spoke without notes for several minutes, and everyone paid close attention, and rightly so. Among other things, Pete spoke about something called veterans courts. Not every county in Minnesota has one, but where they are in operation, veterans courts are seeing a substantial success in helping military vets who get, shall we say, crosswise with the law. I thought it would be a good idea to invite Pete Orpett to this program to share his insights with you. Pete, thank you for coming down.
Oh, thanks so much for this opportunity, Stan. And while I'm at it, I want to thank you again for your very generous time in emceeing that Vietnam Veterans event. That meant a lot to us.
Well, it's the other way around. I've always felt a special debt to the Vietnam vets. You're a vet.
Yes,
I was called up, went through the physical and the whole thing, and it looked like I was going over. But I got it. I didn't ask for it, but I got to affirm it because I had a skin disorder called eczema.
Oh,
it
sure.
Was all over my body.
Very
and the doctor painful. Looked at me and said, "You're out of here."
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would have been with you in the foxholes over there. So
you'd be with me.
I didn't
talking about it.
I didn't go, but I feel a special debt, you know, to be with these wonderful guys and gals too. I did a show with the military nurses. You remember them over there.
Didn't see too many, but I saw some USO gals.
Right,
yeah.
I bet you would have wished you would have seen more of them.
Indeed.
You were a Marine over there?
I was, sir.
Right.
Yes.
Many aspects of your keynote speak to the veterans last March up in Forest Lake are noteworthy. The whole speech is noteworthy. I wish I'd recorded it. What really stuck me in my mind was the veterans courts you talk about.
Yes,
you, I know you're instrumental in having set one up in your county here in Washington. Also Hennepin, I think, too. Tell us, just give us a definition. What is veteran? What are veterans courts?
Well, there's many different iterations, Stan, of it. Just to take you back, I was a Hennepin County prosecutor several years ago. And I was friends with a
prosecutor from Erie County, Pennsylvania, and she called me up one day in 2007 and said, you might be interested, they formed a veterans court. And by this time, 2007, I had been cycling Iraq and Afghanistan war vets through the criminal courts in Hennepin County. Well, she told me a little bit about it. I got on the phone and I called the judge there, and I learned that they were the first veterans court program in the country. In a nutshell, they see veterans, combat veterans, as having some unique maladies that almost invariably are going to get them in a criminal justice system. So if they are unique, let's treat them uniquely. And that was the genesis of it. Soon thereafter, I started working on forming a veterans court here in Minnesota. And the first one we had was Hennepin County. And wouldn't you know, by the time it got up and going, I ran for election in Washington County. So I helped create the second one here in the state.
So do we have two? Is that the total?
Seven? Well, actually, it's grown significantly. Mm-hmm. After we set up our program, Carver County, Anoka County, Ramsey County, and some rural counties such as Polk County all set up veterans courts too. And it's become a good thing because it does the right thing to the right person.
I'm going to have you tell us how, you know, some without revealing, of course, the people involved, but some real life cases about how. But before you do, I can almost hear we have some Korean War vets listening right now, and some World War II vets too, and they're saying, "Well, I was in combat, and I came back, and I kept my nose out of trouble, but there was nothing like this for us. Had I gotten crosswise with the law?" And they're wondering, is this special treatment for Vietnam vets, for Gulf War vets, for Iraq, Afghanistan vets? You drew a distinction, and a very interesting one, between Vietnam vets, their experience, and the currently serving troops.
First of all, our veterans court serves all veterans. Not too many World War II guys left. My father served in the Marines in World War II, and I saw how he chose not to deal with his issues. I think this generation's a little different than that one. But at any rate, our veterans court, it's not a two-tier justice system in that it's not different for vets than other folks. Everybody deserves to get treated uniquely. The problem is, returning combat vets all have a cluster of issues that all seem terribly similar, and they do require the right intervention.
What are they, Pete?
Well, for most part, post-traumatic stress disorder, it didn't even get diagnosed till 1983. So the Vietnam vets never got any treatment for that. If it doesn't exist, they can't treat it, and they wouldn't name it. Now, we're very aware of it. But the other things we've seen is a significant spike in suicides among serving members and veterans getting out, a lot of post-traumatic stress, a lot of what we call moral injury, which is a lot of guilt about their time in combat. And then they come home, and this is a few years ago, we had a 25% unemployment rate for returning combat vets. Take the unemployment rate, untreated PTSD, and you've got yourself a problem. And the problem is, a lot of guys would self-medicate. And you know and I know that when you try to drink your problems away or smoke them away or whatever else you do, invariably, mm-hmm. you're going to get it caught up in mm-hmm. the law.
You've been forthright about you self-medicated.
I did, and I'm in recovery, and mm-hmm. God bless, I've had yeah. several 24-hour yeah. periods of recovery.
Mm-hmm. Moral injury, an interesting term you've used there. Returning vets who have been in combat suffer from what you call moral injury. What is that?
It's a concept that incorporates the huge guilt veterans have. Why did I live and my buddy died? That's one variation. Another one is, and this is a significant one, Stan, we're taught from when we're the youngest kids, thou shalt not kill. And then we send them to combat and say, well, here's an exception to that deeply ingrained value of not killing. And when you transgress that and come back, those issues are there, and they can be difficult.
I've talked to, among other law enforcement, the State Patrol, and they've told me about returning vets from the Persian Gulf War, Iraq and Afghanistan. As you say, they've been trained with the best technology, and in a sense, killing technology, you know, and, yes, and they know how to operate it. We have great troops. There's no doubt about it. They come back. They survive, but they're psychologically scarred in many cases. They're used to driving hard, driving fast in the combat zones. They come back here, and suddenly it's this tranquil pasture, bucolic setting. But they're still in overdrive, aren't they?
Well,
and they want to get on the motorcycles, and they want to get a belly full of booze and get out. Well, some, I'm not saying all, some of them do, and that's the scenario the State Patrol painted for me.
Well, that's a very good point.
As an inquiring reporter one day.
Well, and Stan, the biggest point out of that is I'm talking only about a few veterans, not every veteran, a select few. But we've all agreed we're not leaving anybody behind, and that means the guys coming back. State Patrol, local law enforcement, all came together in Washington County when we wanted to set up this program. We wanted their input. We wanted to tell them the programming that gets involved in it, if people choose to get in it, and they were fully supportive because they see it too.
Does this work like drug courts? I've done some work on this.
Very similar, Stan. Drug courts tailor the treatment to the individual. In this court, what happens is, in my court, put it that way, someone will commit a crime, typically a felony, maybe a misdemeanor. If I had to categorize them, a lot of domestic incidents. They're sitting down in the basement playing violent video games, drinking, can't find work. Next thing you know, they get in a domestic. Well, at any rate, they come in, they apply. We screen them for application, several of us from my office, three of whom are combat vets. If we think they're eligible, we send them out to the Veterans Administration, who does a full and thorough review of them, psych testing, chemical dependency testing, all those kinds of things. They come up with a recommendation for treatment. Then if the offender and we agree to it, we put them in the program. If they successfully complete the program, they're not saddled with a felony or a misdemeanor conviction.
It's almost like a college curriculum in a way, isn't it? If you graduate, in a sense, don't you? Like the drug courts?
Very much
so. If you make it through?
If they can make it through. And Stan, I got to say, what these troops are asked to do is so arduous that some say, no, I'd rather just go to jail and do my time.
Really?
Several, actually, out of the close to 60 veterans we screened for coming in, we put in about 30, and several of the other 30 didn't want to do it. They go, I'd rather spend my weekend playing Monopoly in jail.
Wow.
Well, the way I look at it is I go, if you're not ready now, keep my card. Someday you'll be ready.
We want to underscore, and you've already mentioned this, Pete Orpett, Washington County Attorney, that it's a fraction of veterans who violate the law, who get involved in the criminal court system and all the rest. But nevertheless, these people, I would guess, left untreated, they do get into a cycle, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
Of violation, of arrest, of incarceration, and then release, and then back in the system, the cycle repeats itself.
Sure, they stay on the merry-go-round, Stan. Yeah. We get calls from their spouses or loved ones saying, can't you help my partner? And once we get them in a program, we've had phenomenal success. Unbelievable. Because the theory is, these guys, they didn't go into service and serve our country as criminals. I'm reluctant to brand them a criminal when they get out, when the theory is, we sent them over there for multiple tours. They break. I think we're obligated to fix them.
You raise a very important point. Vietnam, you were in Vietnam. As a Marine, I think you had to do 13 months,
yes,
didn't
sir.
You, for the tour. And if you survived, you were out of there, weren't you? Back
Indeed.
To the world?
Yes, sir.
I guess for non-Marine combatants, what was it?
12
months. Okay, so you had a finite a term of duty over there, overseas.
Yes, sir.
Unlike today, there's a difference, isn't it?
It's a significant difference, Stan. I'm glad you brought it up. These troops will go to Iraq or Afghanistan, and unlike the Vietnam vets, there's no defined tour. They'll say you're here for 6 months, but you may be extended. The troops I see in court have done multiple tours, or tours that last 24, 26 months, and even longer.
Yeah. And the corresponding damage that can do to family life, too. Is
very difficult.
So.
Especially, we've never seen things like the National Guard that got mobilized. We saw it in World War II, but very little in Korea and hardly at all in Vietnam.
Right.
And in these wars, the National Guard, Our National Guard unit from Stillwater has been deployed at least three times.
They're front line. Citizen soldiers, they're called.
Yes.
These are the front line people, men and women.
Leave your job, leave your family, come back 2 years later, hope you can reintegrate without trouble.
Pete Orpett, Washington County Attorney, a man who has helped establish veterans courts in Washington County, in Hennepin County, and they're spreading elsewhere. A very good thing indeed. We're going to take a quick break here, Pete. We'll be right back. You finally found it, that old photograph of your grandmother that you've always wanted to share with your grandchildren, but it's torn, cracked, and faded. Well, don't despair. Bring it in to Images of the Past in Stillwater. They specialize in restoring and preserving memories for future generations. So when you bring your old photos to Images of the Past, you can share that beautiful photograph with your grandchildren. You can see examples at klbbradio.com. Keyword, photo. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past.
Timeless tastes and timeless ingredients are why people ask for Wolf's. So which Wolf's will you ask for? The Strong Golden Belgian Style Ale is light-bodied, yet seductively strong warmer. Maybe it's the Berlin-style Weiss, the sour wheat ale that's dubbed the Champagne of the North. Or perhaps it's the German-style ale Weizenbach, the dark wheat ale brewed to Bach strength. Whichever, make sure you ask for Wolf's. Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
Valley Booksellers' popular program, Totally Criminal Cocktail Hour, meets Wednesday, May the 6th at the Water Street Inn. Starting at 4:30, the $10 registration fee includes delicious appetizers and a cash bar is available. This month's book is Season of Fear by Brian Freeman. The book's available at the store. To reserve your spot, call Valley Booksellers 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. We are back with Pete Orpett, Washington County Attorney, who, among other things, has helped set up veterans courts in this county and others around the state of Minnesota. We hope to see more and more of them. They are working. The empirical data are very encouraging, Pete. You're not having any shortage of takers. These are military veterans who go astray sometime. We realize they are a minority of returning combat vets, but nonetheless, when they get in trouble, they get in trouble. And like you say, sometimes they get into a merry-go-round, a cycle of offenses, arrest, conviction, and they do their time behind bars, and they're right back out again in trouble again.
It's true. We do limit it, Stan, to serious violent offenses.
Okay. What would those be? What's an example?
Oh, say a rape, an armed robbery. In fact, unfortunately, I prosecuted a two-tour veteran who decided to go out and rob people, and I sent him to prison. I said, no veterans court for him. We can't. We have to draw the line somewhere.
Okay. You came back from Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
An angry man. Tell us about it. Well, you've written about that.
Well, you know, it's true. I try to stay positive today.
But I'm saying this helps people, I think, you know, as you work through your emotions and got to a positive place.
You know, what the trouble, Stan, is you come home, and for me, I felt like a Martian. You know, my head shaved. No one was happy to see me, and so I kind of stumbled around. I did go to the University of Minnesota, and I immediately got hooked up with a veterans group there. They had a vets club, and they were incredibly helpful. But other than that, I did feel like I was walking around a Martian.
Mm-hmm. Well, you saw Vietnam. No wars are popular, but this one in particular was unpopular. What sort of reception did you get when you came back? I mean, you said nobody was happy to see you. We've heard these stories, and I have a lot of friends who are Vietnam vets. Some of them were literally spit upon. At the least, they were ostracized, even by members of their own family. They didn't want anything to do with them.
A number of stories. Mine is probably far less poignant than others, but there were a small group of us from Minnesota that hung out together. We flew into Norton Air Force Base, which is outside of Los Angeles, had an Air Force man drive us to LAX. When we got there, we were surrounded by Hare Krishna people. And there were probably 20 of them, and there were four of us Marines. and they wouldn't leave us alone, and they were really bugging us. And a good friend of mine from Red Lake, Minnesota, wasn't taking it too well. I made sure I got us out of there before we landed in jail. So we walk into the airport. We've got a couple hours to grind. We go into the local bar, and the bartender immediately asks for ID. Well, you know, none of us were 21, ironically, and so he wouldn't serve us. And the irony of that was pretty tough. A couple of my buddies wanted to break the joint up.
I get it.
And it went from there. It was a lot of fun from there.
Yeah. Serving your country in combat, and you're not old enough to order a beer.
You can't have a beer. No, yeah, you can shoot people, you can blow up villages, but don't have a beer.
PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What is it, Pete?
Well, it's somewhat hard to define, but actually it's simple. It's you haven't been able to let go of the stress that you had, and it's deep in there, and it really pervades your whole self, where you're walking around numb to everything. And when things do start to come up and you start to feel them, you do everything you can to run away from it. Booze looks like it works, marijuana, other hard drugs, but it doesn't. So the post-traumatic stress won't go away. But if you go through the programming that the VA finally has, and it's comprehensive, you'll learn to manage it. And that's about as good as it's going to get.
Mm-hmm. The veterans courts, again, what's the number of counties that currently have such a court?
I think we're up to eight. Here,
so
about 160 in the United States. They've really taken off.
Yeah, okay. It obviously, it's a good thing, and others are watching. We have, 87 counties in the state of Minnesota, so we have a way to go. And a lot of them are, it's taken a while, but drug courts, too, have been slow to take off. But where they have been implemented, especially in the metro area, I think Duluth has a couple, too. St. Louis is such a huge county. I think they've got a couple going up there. They seem to be working very well.
They do work. We've had several graduates stand, and it's amazing the turnaround these veterans have had. Their families call us and say, thanks for giving me my partner back, my husband back. He's not the same, but he's a lot better than he was. And like I say, we just get him to manage some of the pain.
The military tries to help before deployment and after deployment, especially with husbands and wives and kids, don't they? I mean, there is an effort
they
being put forward.
They do now. Yeah. You remember the war started, the Iraq war in 2003, and I think they were really slow to recognize what was happening. Then when the suicide rate became so profoundly embarrassing, they realized they had to step in. And there is a lot of programming for servicemen before they get out. Maybe not enough for some.
Pete, let's broaden out the discussion here for a moment. Let's look at Washington County, where you are county attorney. What is the crime picture in this county right now? I noticed a piece the other day about hard drug use. Meth use is up in Hennepin-Ramsey County. Heroin is up. Cocaine's down. I don't know. It goes up and down. What's the picture around here with respect to hard drugs?
Well, the bottom line, Stan, is we're not immune to what we're seeing all over the state. And what we're seeing is, in my view, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic about it, but I call it an epidemic, even in our county. In our county alone, we've buried an average of 15 young people a year for drug overdose deaths. That doesn't count the 300-plus emergency room visits where they've been able to save overdose. What's driving that? The ubiquitous nature of prescription drugs, heroin, and, again, the Mexican methamphetamine. But it's become just awful.
What about the Mexican meth? Tell us about that.
Well,
pipeline right from...
Essentially. Yeah. In fact, I've got a case in my office where the police arrested some guys who were transporting on a weekly basis 20 pounds of methamphetamine up from Arizona, which came right over the border from Mexico. And unlike the methamphetamine that people were making with a process using Sudafed and other pseudoephedrine drugs, this stuff is very pure, very powerful. A lot like that show Breaking Bad.
Well, yeah, home kitchen labs have pretty well gone away. They were literally explosive, too, weren't they? There were houses blowing up.
Terrible.
Okay, so we legislated against that, but now this let's call it a death line, not a lifeline, from Mexico right into here, and it's taking young lives.
It's awful. And with the meth comes the heroin, comes the very potent marijuana, and It's really having an effect on our people.
How about pseudo drugs?
Well, the synthetic drugs are also a huge problem. They call them like 25-INBOME, but variations on the molecular theme. These are synthetic drugs being sold as LSD, and it's not. The bath salts are another thing. We've taken the bath salts out, but we still see these synthetic drugs. In fact, we had an overdose death of a young woman by taking it.
What percentage, this is a tough question, but just generally, what percentage of the felonies that you process in Washington County have to do with drugs?
Oh, anecdotally, Stan, that's got to be very high. Yeah. If you lump drugs and alcohol, I'd guess 80-85% of my cases.
Wow.
Drugs and alcohol don't work when trying to live your life because you're going to end up getting in trouble with the law, either selling it or acting out when you're high or causing violent crimes. It's just terrible.
How about anger on the highway, Pete?
We still get that, too. Not
rage.
Too many.
Really? Is it starting to...
Well, we haven't seen much, despite all the construction traffic. We get scared with, we're coming into construction season, and with that, people get road rage. But I think we're courteous drivers in East Metro here. I really do.
I'd like to think that. Some days I can't think that.
Well, and some days I wish I were a police officer so I could pull that knucklehead over. But
you do ride-alongs. As a newsman, I've done some ride-alongs with the cops, and it just underscores the fact I never would want to be a law enforcement officer. It is so dangerous, so difficult. And in the news now, and I'm in that business, we see where some cops go astray. And when they go astray, you prosecute them, and others prosecute them as they should be.
Yep.
But by and large, day in, day out, they're pretty good people. We know that. It's a difficult job.
I get a little embarrassed that every day I read the paper, there's something else.
Yeah.
Because that's not the cops I work with. It just isn't.
The ride-along thing, I remember going along with the St. Paul cops years ago, and they would call it a slow night, a non-eventful. But they're in there. They're social engineers, the cops are.
Oh, yeah.
3 in the morning, a drunken couple, kids with dirty diapers crawling on the floor, haven't eaten for 2 or 3 days. The cops know the kids by name. They'll take them down to social services. So the kids will be back here in 24 hours, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough being a cop some days, too.
Well,
I'm not excusing the bad behavior of some of them, a fraction. But, day in and day out, it's a tough job.
I would welcome citizens to contact their local police department and ask for a ride-along and see what it's like. I've done several around here, but coming from having been a prosecutor in Hennepin, I get my Minneapolis police friends call me every now and then and ask me to go ride along.
Great.
And it's a great deal of fun. Comparing Minneapolis without hearing the crime and that.
Yeah? What do you see? What's
extremely violent crime in certain neighborhoods of Minneapolis. And the cops there, they'll do a 10-hour shift, stand, and it will be 10 hours of answering 911 calls stacked up. They can't get to them quick enough. So by the end of the shift, I understand these guys are beat. And I'm afraid that's where a few of the cops act out some of that stress.
Guys and gals.
A lot of
ladies on the force, too.
Many.
Yep, absolutely. And, well, what do you want to add about Veterans Courts, B? We're just about out of time here.
I'd love the public's interest in it. I'd love their input in it. If they have a veteran at home that's suffering, I wish they'd seek help. The VA have really stepped it up in helping our veterans these days.
Where's the first call for help? Where do they go?
Well, it depends on the thing. If you didn't know where to go, you simply call the Veterans Administration helpline. If it's a suicide, there's a number of veteran suicide lines. The help is there, and it's available, and a lot of the barriers are gone. They just need to seek it out, and that's the hard part. Because like you said earlier, Stan, we've built them tough. And the harder we build them, the less they are willing to surrender.
Wow.
And that makes a tough nut to crack.
It does. Pete Orput, Washington County Attorney. Thank you, Peter, so much. Keep up the good work. We appreciate what you are doing, my friend.
Thank you, Stan. And I want to thank you again for emceeing that Vietnam Veterans Day. That meant a lot to us.
It was my honor, Pete, and I mean that. Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great weekend. You've got the weather to do it, too. Get out there and have fun. We'll see you on the All Request and Dedication program Monday, right after the news at noon. Bye-bye.